This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Cassie Huff with you this wintry Monday afternoon. And didn't autumn go out with a bang in some places? There's been some reasonable falls around the place. I've heard 11.6 mils at Edithburgh, Dina 3, Clare had 9 mils. I heard Woodna had 4, but there was also a lot of wind around. Some crops on the Eyre Peninsula were sandblasted with wind, but still a fair bit of optimism in the area.
There's no need to hit the panic button just yet. We just need some more rain to keep that crust on the surface and give them a chance to grow out of it.
I'd love to know how it's looking at your place, how much rain you had on the weekend, or even for all of May. It was quite a good start to the cropping season. You can text in on 0467 922 891, or call in on 1300 222 891 with your records from May or even just over the weekend. I'll also be touching our base with the hay industry in the next half hour to see how it's going as the global feed trade faces uncertain times. But the news that's dominated the headlines has been riots in the US. The wool industry's R&D and marketing body, Australian Wool Innovation, is reassessing how quickly the United States economy and retail sector will recover in light of the weekend riots. Protests have continued across the country after the death of George Floyd, a black man who died in police custody in Minneapolis. Stuart McCulloch is the CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, and he says that the US riots add another layer of uncertainty to an economy and retail sector still reeling from the effects of COVID-19.
Look, all their doors over there in terms of retail garment selling businesses, all those doors have been closed for a fair while. It's just another layer of damage that's being done to that economy. We always felt, or we felt for a little while, that China would emerge out of COVID probably the quickest because of their population and the affluence they have there now. And we thought the US wouldn't be far behind them, but we're starting to reassess that and make sure that, you know, if we are deploying demand creation dollars and energy by way of our human resources we have there, that it's done in a place that's going to yield. And this is the issue we have at the moment.
So how do you see wool prices shaping up for the rest of the year? I mean, you know, the prices have been in steady decline since 2018. Where is it heading now?
Yeah, look, we're trying to get a grip on that right now. It's very difficult to predict when you've got it. Literally every retail business in the world with their doors closed. What we're trying to understand is from our processes, whether they be in Italy or in China or anywhere else in the world, what sort of orders are coming through for the fall winter selling season. That's the Northern Hemisphere autumn winter selling season. You know, in some ways, COVID hit when the spring summer collections were going into store. So, and wool's not typically known to sell in spring summer. It can. There are some garments that are applicable, but wool is mostly sold in the autumn winter selling season. The purchasing for autumn winter is starting right now for fibre, and then it goes through the supply chain and into garments. And we're just trying to get a grip on, get more perfect information on what size those orders are that are coming through to the factories, wherever they might be, and whether they're down on last year's orders, cancelled from last year orders, or up on last year orders. We don't expect them to go up, mind you, but we're just trying to get a figure on what those downsizings of those orders are.
So it just depends on where that lands in terms of where the prices are heading, but it certainly doesn't sound promising.
It depends on how that country reopens, how they get those doors of those retail businesses reopened, how quickly normal life continues. It also depends on potentially when a vaccine comes through. So there's a whole lot of unknowns that we were dealing with at the moment. And from our point of view, we've largely shut down all our marketing projects temporarily to preserve those dollars to make sure that we can discharge them at a time where it's going to yield for our wool growers.
So really just find out which market sort of comes out of this first, and that's where the focus, the money will go?
Absolutely. We've got to expanded our business intelligence unit of the company dramatically. We've turned those offices that we have overseas from project management businesses into really data collection offices, business intel offices, so that we can get more perfect information. It's very dangerous to make decisions with imperfect information, and it's very imperfect at the moment. In a month's time or a couple of months' time, it'll be a little bit more perfect, but still not absolutely perfect. So, look, we'll make those decisions on deployment of dollars and humans, resources, when we can get a clear picture on how that market's going to yield, how that company that we work with is going to yield for demand creation, and potentially categories of, you know, is it going to be formal apparel, or is it going to be casual apparel or technical apparel that's going to come out of this best?
It's a lot to take in from the events in the US, and it's affecting lots of industries. That was the CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, Stuart McCulloch, speaking with Belinda Varischetti. Now, you may have heard that today is World Milk Day. After the weather, I'm going to be looking at why June the 1st is so important to Australian dairy farmers. But in the meantime, dairy cows on the Fluria Peninsula have been munching on something a little different these days, and that is biochar. Trials have shown that adding activated charcoal to dairy feed results in a milk yield increase of 1.4 litres per cow per day. Director of Research Demonstration Extension Company Climate and Agriculture Support, Melissa Rebick, says the increase is even greater for younger cows.
We increase the milk yield by 1.4 litres per head per day on average, and that was consistent for an entire year. And in fact, we found that the younger animals, the two-year-old animals, increase their milk yield by up to 2 litres per head per day. Something with the rumen, and actually there's a number of papers that talk about biochar in the rumen and its redox active properties, if you like. And so it kind of stimulates the rumen and gives it better feed efficiency, a better uptake of minerals and nutrients and better feed conversion. So the animals are able to, you know, convert that more efficient production into milk yield. But there's also possibilities to feed it to beef cattle and sheep. And in fact, farmers have done it. Just needs to be more research trials in that space. But our dairy ones were really positive, because we improved the milk yield by 1.4 litres per head per day. And then we also went on to measure benefits from the biochar as it's not digested and stays active in the manure, and then benefits the soil and then the pasture.
Being able to increase milk yield by 1.4 litres, what did that translate to for the farmers?
So that worked out to, on the current milk prices, be around about $70,000 increase in profitability just by feeding that biochar. And that's taking out the cost of the biochar. So the biochar is only fed at 0.03 to 0.5% of their intake. And in fact, this dairy only fed it at 150 grams per head per day. So that worked out to about 13 tonnes for a year, which wasn't very much.
And as you said, the biochar isn't ingested, so ends up in the manure. What happens from there in terms of improving the soil health?
We measured the manure properties and found that the biochar-fed animals had a more highly mineralised manure, if you like, and more carbon. But in the presence of dung beetles, and the Fluria have got a lot of those because of the work of Fluria Beef Group and dairy properties having winter and summer active dung beetles. So that dung with activated carbon or the biochar is then buried by the dung beetles and improves the soil health. And so we've measured improvements in the soil health as well. We've measured an increase in the pH. So soil acidity is a big problem on the Fluria, and we've actually measured an increase in just 9 months of one unit in pH. We've also measured some really good indicators like the cation exchange capacity, which basically just shows that your minerals and nutrients are more available to the plant. We also found an increase in the fungi in the soil, which a lot of soils that are treated heavily with fertilisers have too much bacteria and not enough fungi. So it kind of brings things back into balance and basically lets all the microorganisms work more harmoniously for those nutrients and minerals then to be taken up by the plant.
Some promising research there. That was the Climate and Agriculture Support Director, Melissa Rebick, speaking to Grace Whiteside there. I'm just imagining cows with black teeth eating the charcoal, but yeah, sounds like it's doing quite a good job there for them. Listening to the Country Hour, it's 12:15.
Evenings with Peter Gers.
Knock, knock.
No, you didn't say knock, knock.
Knock, knock.
Go away. Go away. I'm in isolation.
Weeknights from 7.
Why did the PowerPoint presentation cross the road? To get to the other slide. Boom.
Peter Gers.
PFO. What does that mean?
Ah, that stands for... That's the code for pissed and fell over. Yes.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, close to the wire is how hay export company Balco has described being able to access overseas containers to fill their orders during the coronavirus pandemic. Export hay represents about 10% of Australia's fodder industry, and the Mid-North and Mallee are part of the three main regions that grow it. Chief Executive of Balco, Rob Lawson, says the industry is looking more stable, but they're keeping a close eye on the trade tension between Australia and China.
The export hay market has been, it's been pretty strong. Sales have been good into our Asian markets, and actually every country's been reasonably consistent. Obviously, we are watching the environment and the trade environment between Australia and China at the present moment, but at this stage, we're relatively unaffected in the hay business.
As you mentioned, there tariffs on barley, ban on some red meat producers. Do you have concern for the hay industry from that perspective?
We're certainly watching it very closely. You know, we've got a lot of long-term, very loyal customers in China who we have a great relationship with. But obviously, the discussions are at government levels. Probably the hay industry is reasonably, you know, we're reasonably minor compared to the trade of barley and some of the meat trade.
Given the pandemic that we are in at the moment, has there been any interruption to your supply chain over the past couple of months?
No, we've been quite fortunate being in the feed business and, you know, fitting in the essential service category. So things have been relatively consistent. However, we're very aware that, you know, just about every economy in the world is going to be affected at the moment. And so we are cautiously, you know, watching what's happening with global trade as a whole, really. But at the moment, it's been fairly smooth going for us.
I know when we spoke a few months back, you mentioned that you were keeping a close eye on your containers to make sure that you could get them back from the Asian ports that they were in. Has there been any change there?
We certainly had a period where containers were very tight and a lot more difficult than normal to get, but we've worked through that and we believe it's just starting to free up. You know, container supply is starting to free up a little bit now, but certainly during the month of April, and early May, we experienced some difficulties. We didn't miss an order, but we certainly had some things that went very close to the wire to get a container. We had to do a lot of extra work to make sure we could supply, get a container for all of our orders.
Was there a particular country that was of concern in terms of those containers?
No, all of our trade is really in Asian ports between Japan, South Korea, China and Taiwan predominantly. And it's equally spread across them all.
Demand for domestic hay we've seen over recent months as it does rain is dropping. Has there been any shift in interest with suppliers looking to export rather than supply into the domestic market?
Oh, not really. For ours, our contracted position, you know, farmers who have contracts with us, those things are done, you know, certainly all complete at the back of 2019. And so, for us, we're not really players in the domestic market, so things have been pretty consistent for us. Certainly, I'm aware with everybody else that the domestic market has softened with the rain and those things, but not a big effect on our business at all, really. Our long-term growers, we have a contracted position and most of them have contracts. In fact, almost all have contracts in place for this year going forward as well. So, you know, what's in the ground other than what's contracted to us is hard for me to say, but we're certainly very satisfied with our contracted position with the growers we partner with.
Chief Executive of Hay Export Company Balco, Rob Lawson, speaking with Grace Whiteside. And there was a bit of rain around. Winter is definitely here. I've had a couple of texts in. Barry from Loxton had only one magnificent millimetre. Steve from Tarawi texted in to say that he's had 2.5 millimetres for the weekend, 14 millimetres for May, and 159 for the year. There's some good numbers there. I'm going to talk to the Weather Bureau shortly about how May panned out. But if you'd like to let me know how much rain you had on the weekend or even for the month of May, you can call in on 1300 222 891 or text 0467 922 891. It was very welcome rain across much of the state, but there was also a lot of wind with it as well, particularly on the Eyre Peninsula, to the point where they were basically sandblasted by the strong winds. Isaac Gill farms at Mangalo and says that the crops were just starting to pop up and they've been hit pretty hard.
It was extremely windy, similar to what we were enduring last year. Very dusty conditions and it wasn't very nice for probably half a day, and then we were lucky to get a couple of mils of rain and a bit of a shower, and the wind kept up, but that stopped the dust, and yeah, there's been a bit of damage around the place, unfortunately.
What sort of damage?
Just wind erosion, the paddocks that were quite bare, that were nearly covered, had crops up, and there was just, you know, another 2 or 3 weeks, and they would have well and truly been covered and been quite good. Now they've really been set back and sandblasted, so hopefully with some fine weather and a bit more moisture over the coming weeks, and they'll recover.
How much rain would you need for them to recover?
Well, we had 8.5 mils over the weekend, which was quite welcomed, and it'd just been more of a case of waiting and seeing. They've really only been sandblasted twice now, and they should recover, but it's a matter of waiting and seeing what the weather's like. It's sort of out of our hands, and just got to sit back and wait and see.
How much rain have you had for the year?
We've had about 130 mils for the year, but we've had 45 mils since the start of April. So we've had quite a reasonable start, and we've got all the crop in and finished seeding 3 weeks ago, and been quite good, but just most frustrating for everyone that we had that wind on the weekend.
Those crops that have been sandblasted, is there the potential for them to be affected further into the season with their growth and things like that, or is it a bit hard to tell?
I think there's still a lot of potential. There's no need to hit the panic button just yet. We just need some more rain to keep that crust on the surface and give them a chance to grow out of it. It's really out of our hands, but we've sort of all done as much as we can. No one likes looking at their paddocks and seeing them drifting. And we've tried to get our crops in as early as we can, but unfortunately you just can't control Mother Nature.
We heard last week the Bureau said that there's some good chance for some winter rains this year. That must be a little bit promising, but I guess you can't always rely on what they say.
Well, it's a welcome change from the last couple of years. It's certainly given everyone a lot more hope, and everyone's a bit more confident that it can rain. We were starting to wonder if it ever would rain the last couple of years, but no, hopefully it'll return to a near winter pattern. And we don't need big rain to get a crop. We just need reasonable rains at the right time.
And hopefully they come through this year. That was Mangalo farmer Isaac Gill speaking to Brooke Neindorf. Now, to get a sense of what the start of June holds weather-wise, we'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology. We're joined by senior forecaster Mark Anilak. Hi, Mark. You there, Mark? Looks like we're having some trouble getting Mark to air. You there, Mark?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mark. So just wondering what's happening with the start of June weather-wise?
Look, we're in for a pretty clear start, I guess. We've had quite a vigorous couple of cold fronts move through at the weekend. They've now moved off into the eastern states, and a high pressure system will bring a return to, I guess, fine conditions for the early part of for this week. So it remained quite cool for this week, the first week of June and winter. Early morning frost and fogs are expected right across South Australia at various times, so very cold nights ahead under mostly clear skies. There are just a couple of, very weak troughs moving up onto the coastal fringes in this southerly airstream, so we'll probably see the first one of those come through late Tuesday. We're likely to see a slight, a chance of showers pushing up onto the southern agricultural area late Tuesday, early Wednesday. That should clear off pretty quickly. And another weak front coming up early hours of Saturday morning. So overnight, Friday night into Saturday, there's a chance of some light shower activity about the southern coastal fringes. But for the rest of the state, it should be mostly clear. And like I said, very cold mornings coming up, particularly later in the week. With Thursday, Friday, Saturday looking very cold in the mornings and quite extensive areas of frost expected later in the week. In terms of rainfall amounts, not too much left in it really. These stream showers or southwesterly flow bringing showers to the coastal fringes is likely to bring falls of 2 to 10 millimetres over the coming days. But once we move sort of into the northern agricultural area and the south of the pastoral districts, they can expect very little rainfall this week. So and that's pretty much how the week looks like it'll pan out. I can briefly go back and have a look at the May and autumn climate stats, if you like, Cassie.
Yeah, well, it seems like some areas had a pretty good month, really, to lead into winter.
For May itself, most of the state was probably a little bit below average in terms of rainfall, making it the driest May for South Australia since about 2006. There were some very dry areas. The northeastern part of Eyre Peninsula saw very little rainfall. I think Cleve had 9 millimetres, Cowal had only 11 millimetres, making it their driest May in some 20 years. So very, very dry in some parts of the state, but other areas did see a little bit more. And for Adelaide, we saw rainfall around near average, and the temperatures across the state were pretty much below average through May. Looking a bit further ahead into autumn, or a bit further ahead, a bit further back, for the entire autumn, the 3 months through autumn, generally temperatures across the state were below average, and that resulted because we had a little bit more rainfall across the state than average. Tail and Bend had the highest rainfall, its highest autumn rainfall in over 20 years with 144.3 millimetres of rain for those 3 months. But generally, the eastern parts of the state or the eastern districts did see above average rainfall, and central and western parts were average to a little bit below average through March, April, May. Adelaide itself had a dry start to the season, with March being quite dry, but with some quite significant rainfall events through April and May, bringing our average back to sort of near average. And in fact, I think Adelaide's rainfall through to for the 3 months was about 141 millimetres, which is just slightly above average. Locally, Woodhouse had 306 millimetres for the state, and that was the highest rainfall for the state for autumn. So pretty wet and a little bit cool as well for the last 3 months, Cassie.
Right. It's interesting you say that it was a bit below average. I guess it just has to come at the right time. Doesn't necessarily have to be a lot by the sounds of things.
Yep.
Thanks so much for that, Mark.
Okay.
That was Mark Analak from the Weather Bureau speaking there. We'll just pop to the far west of New South Wales. It's going to be mostly sunny in the upper western. Overnight temperatures will fall to about 5 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching up to about 16 degrees. Pretty similar in the lower western as well, partly cloudy there. Overnight temperatures will fall to about 5 degrees, and then during the day it should reach between 14 to 17 degrees. Coming up on the program, we're going to hear why it's Mad Milk Monday. There's a lot happening in the milk sector today. That's all coming up in the next half hour.
You're-
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, I'm Cassie Huff with you this wintry Monday afternoon. Today is the 1st of June, which makes it World Milk Day. It's a day to celebrate and raise a glass of milk to toast the dairy industry. Maybe you could put some extra cheese on your sandwich this lunchtime, or perhaps have a warm drink of milk before you head to bed tonight. Lots of things you can do with dairy. And as coincidence would have it, it's also Dairy D-Day. Some people are even calling it Mad Milk Monday. It's the day when dairy farmers will find out what processors will pay for their milk. We'll find out if it's what farmers hope it will be, and whether it will give them more information about who they sell to. I'm also going to head to the high seas for the closure of the rock lobster industry for the year. It's been a volatile one with prices rising and falling.
As much as I like to sell into the domestic market, the viability of our business is hindered by selling to the local market, just because the prices you get from China are quite often double of what you can sell them for here. So it's like a farmer selling his sheep or cows at half the price he can get from it. It's pointless, really.
We'll take a look at what has been a volatile year for South Australia's rock lobster industry. We'll head across to the news desk now, though. We're joined by Wendy Glamachak. Hi, Wendy.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this hour, protesters have returned to the streets across America, with violence flaring in pockets of largely peaceful demonstrations fueled by the killings of black people at the hands of police. The National Guard's been activated in 15 states and in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, a truck driver's been arrested after appearing to drive at a crowd of protesters on a Minneapolis freeway at high speed. Officials say no protesters were hit. Businesses across South Australia are reopening their doors today to increase numbers of clients and customers as more coronavirus restrictions are peeled back. Hospitality venues and gyms can now host up to 80 people from today, depending on the space they have. And beauty salons, theatres and galleries have also been allowed to reopen. And the Prime Minister says now is not the time to apologise for the government's robo-debt scheme. That's despite the fact that the government's acknowledged it was unlawful. Hundreds of thousands of people were issued with computer-generated debt notices without detailed proof of the alleged debts owed to Centrelink, and debt collectors were sent in to demand the payment in some instances. Scott Morrison says with the related class action underway, he won't be saying sorry yet. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Well, as I've been saying, it's Mad Milk Monday and also the 20th World Milk Day, the United Nations Day for celebrating the importance of milk as a global food. And it's also Dairy D-Day for processors. Why? Because today is the deadline for dairy processors to announce the minimum price they'll pay for milk from farmers. This is a brand new concept to have all the prices and announced at the same time, and it's part of the new dairy code of conduct that's designed to help even out the power imbalance between dairy farmers and processors. Australian Consumer and Competition Commission Deputy Chair Mick Keogh explains why it's important.
There was no previous requirement for them to publish that on a certain date, and there were certainly a lot of concerns that there was a sort of a wait and see what the others offer and then we'll decide. So this, in fact, requires all processors to express their offers as competitively as they can on the same day. So that hopefully removes some of that price signalling that might have been occurring. The second issue is that, of course, it means that farmers have a clear at least 30 days to make up their mind about whether the offer that they've been given is acceptable or not. And the advantage, of course, in that having all the offers made public by the dairy processors means farmers can quite easily compare the different offers that are available.
That was Mick Keogh from the ACCC just explaining why this has come about. It's a big change for dairy farmers. It's the first time this has happened. And John Hunt is the chair of the South Australian Dairy Farmers. Hi, John.
How are you going?
So, John, how are you finding Mad Milk Monday?
And actually, it's in mud and grass and cows at the moment. So you've had some good rains. Where there's mud, there's money.
Absolutely. Well, we were just hearing that that May was actually slightly below average, which seems unusual given it's been a much better May than it has been in the last couple of years. Now, this concept of all the processors releasing their milk price by 2 p.m. today, what does that mean for dairy farmers?
Look, I think also added to that, they've got to come up with a price, but they've got to come up with an explanation around that price, like how they came to it. So it's basically giving people the confidence to know, that their process is pretty transparent, which markets they're sort of looking at, and whether it suits the farmers' needs. Because a lot of farmers want to have a relationship with the processor beyond milk price. Obviously very important, but they want to just know a bit of the history about the processes and what their main aims are.
Now, the processors have until 2 p.m. to announce their opening price. I know South Australian milk processor Bestons has announced, I think, $7.20 for milk solids. Are there any other prices out there?
Not that we've heard, and see, I think with Bestons, what's good is that they've also put in there that they've guaranteed the minimum price of $6.80. So, it gives farmers security going forward that for 3 years they're going to get a minimum milk price, and but this year Bestons think that they'll be okay to chase the $7.20.
That's a pretty strong price.
A very strong price. Obviously they need milk, want milk, and they've done their homework, and they can get the right markets to return that to the farmers.
When we're talking about milk solids, that's how people tend to value milk when it goes into value added products like cheese and cream and things like that. But do you think that with this strong opening price from Bestons, do you think you're going to see that from the other processors like Saputo and Fonterra, the other big processors?
I don't think so. I think they'd have to. It'd be a pretty long bow for them to get up there. I hope they do for all farmers concerned. And like I say, I mean, the interesting thing is today, if they don't, there'll have to be an explanation around that, why they don't. I think because they have to open now with a minimum price, people are going to be a little bit more conservative. Sorry, processors are going to be a bit more conservative because, they won't be able to go down. They can only go up. And we all know it's where companies end up is more important than where they start. But I think what farmers are going to like, because it used to just be a bit of a game that used to go on till well into July, August, that everybody was waiting for one processor to open. When one did, all the rest jumped on the bandwagon, if you like, and they miraculously were only a few percent away from each other. So this year will just, this year will give the clarity, I think, and the transparency of what industry's been needing.
And why is the timing important in that it's a couple of months earlier than perhaps it's come out before?
Budgeting's the main thing. New season normally starts on the 1st of July. So it just gives people time to do their income estimations, look at comparing companies, and just being a bit more on the front foot.
Do you think that by announcing these milk prices publicly on the same day, it'll make a difference to dairy farmers' bargaining power?
Yes, it will, because, I mean, like I say, it gives you a month to have a good look around and compare different pricing. Look, but like I say, no one will change for a small amount. It would have to be pretty reasonable to shift the processes, because farmers do want to align with the processor. They want to be interested in what goes on farm. But, if someone's 20 cents away or something like that, they can go, right, why? What's the reason? And have that communication with their processor.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world with COVID-19, there's trade situations, with China putting the tariff on Australian barley. What effect do you think that's going to have on the processors?
Look, it'll make them look out. Dairy's not on the agenda yet, so and hopefully remains that way. So we're not sort of, they'll be looking at it a little bit. We're looking like business as usual. That's the one thing with COVID, it sort of didn't really affect dairy too much. So look, they'll be, their eyes will be open, and which they'll have to be, and they'll do their due diligence just to make sure that they've got their prices right.
And it's World Milk Day. Are you doing anything to celebrate?
Drinking milk.
Drinking milk.
I should have come up with something far better than that. That's all I could. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you now, my father does enjoy a glass of milk still before he goes to bed. So I guess he'll raise it as a toast to dairy farmers on World Milk Day.
No worries.
Thanks for that, John.
Cheers, eh? See ya.
That was John Hunt, who is with the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association, talking about what this change to the way dairy farmers find out about milk prices is and how it's going to work. And as he says there, it could potentially improve the bargaining power of dairy farmers. So some interesting prices still yet to come out. The deadline is 2 p.m., so tomorrow we might bring you some more prices and just see what dairy farmers look like. They could be being paid through the year. It is 20 to 1 here on the program. And David Littleproud, the Federal Agriculture Minister, made some comments about setting up a $2 billion biodiversity fund to pay farmers for conservation or biodiversity work, and the National Farmers Federation has backed the idea. As Michael Condon reports, the NFF are reaching out to farmer members to give them feedback and help them shape the way a scheme like that could work.
Paying farmers to set aside their land for improved environmental or biodiversity outcomes is not a new idea, but it's something that farmers have been calling for. They say that they're already the environmental stewards for the entire nation and they should be compensated for that. The NFF's Tony Maher.
It's really about biodiversity and maintaining and improving biodiversity and sustainability. And what we want to do is obviously to grow the agricultural sector, grow productivity, profitability. So it's about central to the idea is agriculture and farming and rewarding farmers and the good practices and processes that they've got in place that they do every day on behalf of all Australians. I mean, our view is that farmers manage up to 50% of the land mass in this country, and it's about time that they got rewarded for all of those good practices. I mean, there has been some suggestions in the past that, you know, there's been statutory theft and farmers have been, you know, had that decision taken away, what they do on their land. That's not what we want. We want a system where, you know, farmers are rewarded, they've got control over what they do on their property. And let's design a system here that will actually do that, will allow farmers to continue to grow their businesses and continue to produce their food and fibre, but maintain the biodiversity and sustainability in the landscapes. I mean, we all want healthy landscapes. We want productive rural and regional economies. So that's what this is actually about, is let's look at what's worked, what has failed, learn from that, and design up a system that can be market-driven, sustainable, and rewarding for farmers.
Because some of the criticism of the US scheme was that they were basically paying farmers not to farm to reduce production to increase prices.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we don't want. In similar cases in Europe where, you know, people are paid not to farm and paid to maintain landscapes around a particular thing, we want to, you know, decouple it from production so that it is, you know, market driven. It provides real growth for the sector.
Now, the other issue too is just going back to that carbon sequester issue. So you were sort of saying that, you know, you wouldn't want government to then come in and take carbon credits off land that had been set aside with this fund.
No, and this is what we've got to actually design. So carbon is one aspect that, you know, obviously is quite complex, and we need methodologies and you know, details around how that would work. This isn't all about carbon or just about carbon. It's about biodiversity, and we've got to design the scheme that can be flexible and can reward all sorts of sustainable criteria or characteristics. So biodiversity, natural capital, you know, these terms can be used interchangeably, but what we want to do is have strict criteria around what we can monetize, what sort of assets are we talking about, how do we measure it? That's the real challenge for this. How do we actually measure what is improving, what's decreasing, and then how do we monetize that into some sort of system? That's what we'd really like people's thoughts and ideas and feedback on how a system will work.
Greg Rummery is an agronomist and grazier at Walgett in New South Wales, and he says he's been paid for a number of years now from a biodiversity trust fund to manage sensitive land on his property. He welcomes the move to some sort of national scheme.
Well, I do think the concept is sound because it
the premise, well, I say that on the premise that it puts a value on a conservation outcome. It actually values conservation. And that's something we haven't really had in a structured way to date. And I think most landholders, most private landholders, have aspects of their land that have conservation or can deliver conservation outcomes for the greater good, and they should be valued. So I think this scheme goes towards achieving that. In that competitive tender process, I was successful. Now I receive an income stream for that portion of the land from the government each year for the next 15 years. And yes, I have to manage that land now for a conservation outcome rather than an agricultural outcome. It's not that I'm unable to graze it, but the grazing of it needs to be done in a strategic way that helps deliver the conservation outcome we've agreed on. That, I think, is a key part of any scheme that's taking public money to deliver a public outcome.
What about the idea that part of this scheme also might be looking to sequester carbon? Any thoughts on that?
Look, the whole carbon sequestration thing, I think, is sound in a broad principle. I think that we've got some way to go yet, at least in a commercial paddock setting, to understanding the numbers that drive that outcome. So are we really sequestering carbon, or are we just seeing a short-term spike in organic matter? So I'm not suggesting the science isn't there, but it's a lot more complicated than I think most landholders, at least, currently think.
And some people feel as though those sort of schemes are open to rorting.
Michael, I think all schemes are open to rorting. That's the bottom line. It's a case of having the right protocols around the scheme so that it is either difficult to rort or unable to be rorting.
But overall, the scheme, the idea of a $2 billion fund to improve some of the environmental outcomes and ultimately improve biodiversity and bird life and animal life, as well as probably improving agricultural outcomes too, you think it's a sound idea?
I think the principles are very sound concept. There's no doubt about that in my mind, but it needs to encapsulate that it's done on a tender basis. It's measured, as in the conservation outcome needs to be measurable. We need to value conservation because conservation is a legitimate land use. A conservation outcome is a legitimate land use, but it hasn't been valued properly.
Greg Rummery in Western New South Wales, who currently receives funding from a state-based biodiversity fund, and before him, Tony Maher, the CEO of National Farmers Federation, looking at this idea of paying farmers for conservation or biodiversity work. I'm interested in what you think on this topic. You can text in on 0467 922 891. We've had a couple of rainfall texts come through. Ellen from Port Elliot had 18 millimetres overnight and 17 millimetres of mills yesterday. And Neil had 12 millimetres at Coffin Bay as well in the past 24 hours. So some good falls there over on the Eyre Peninsula. It's at 12 minutes to one.
Walk with us this National Reconciliation Week
as we explore a variety of perspectives and views on our nation's history.
And look to our future as we discuss the everyday actions we can take to contribute to a positive future for all Australians.
We are all in this together.
National Reconciliation Week from May 27 on ABC Radio, TV and online at abc.net.au/walkingtogether.
Now we're going to head to the southeast because the southern rock lobster industry felt the impacts of COVID-19 almost immediately when China's main market shut down. That was back in January. Now, 5 months later, the South Australian fishing season has come to a close. Bridget Herman caught up with a Cape Jaffa fisherman just before it ended to see the last few lobsters being hauled in and reflect on the last couple of months.
The South Australian southern rock lobster fishing season has come to a close. I headed out with fisherman Sam Gardner and his deckhand Josh Baker to haul in their final catch on board the 17-metre-long Alyeska. The Cape Jaffa marina was calm, but there were choppy waves as soon as we hit the open ocean.
Sometimes the weather will change during the day, and then you just get caught in it.
This fishing season has been marked by the COVID-19 pandemic. It hit the Southern Rock lobster industry in January, the peak of the season, and demand for the product, which mainly sells into China, dropped off virtually overnight.
Stopped and started at the start of the season with the fluctuation of the price, and the craze were going really well, and then the pandemic hit and we took 4 months off from January the 22nd. It wasn't viable to go fishing, and then in the middle of May we came back fishing and finished off. It was just a big unknown, I think. We sell almost 100% of our crayfish to China, so when China doesn't want your crayfish, you really think, oh well, what are we going to do? Will we have to find new markets, or will the price end up coming back up again? It was really unknown. Like, this could have gone on for years, but the price actually came back to what it was previous and earlier in the season after about 4 months. So,
and the lobster that you caught at the start of the season compared to the end of the season, what were they like? Did they change in size or anything?
In the area we were fishing, they were pretty generally the same. They were the first week of the season in October, you'll catch big crays and small crays, and then for the next couple of months, generally in close, they'll be small, and then in the middle of January, you'll catch a lot of big fish, and that continued until we finished in May. We caught a lot of big fish at the end of May.
Fishermen still talk in miles, and Sam tells me we're 2 miles, or more than 3 kilometres, out to sea when the Alyeska arrives at his lobster pots.
All right.
Just one of the wire pots is left to be winched up. It will be his last catch of the season.
Jeez, that's a bit...
Canned Josh looks inside and pulls out 2 large red lobsters.
Probably 3.5 kilos each, as what we call them, as a bull crayfish. And they get a little bit bigger, probably 5 kilo, 5.5, and that's about as big as they grow.
How old would those ones have been?
Probably 35 to 40 years old, those big crays, maybe even older.
It's an ideal end to the season, but when the pandemic first hit, the fishermen didn't know what today would look like.
I think I was hopeful. I was always trying to remain positive. I think it's the way to... There was no real answer to what the price was going to be when the pandemic started to started easing, and I think I always had the feeling that it would go back to what it was, but I think in the end we were lucky it did. It wouldn't have surprised me if we'd been somewhere in the middle of a bad price and a good price, with say $60 a kilo, wouldn't have surprised me, but we were lucky. We finished averaging about $85 a kilo. So.
And why did you choose to stop fishing instead of selling into the domestic market?
As much as I like to sell into the domestic market, the viability of our business is hindered by selling to the local market, just because the prices you get from China are quite often double of what you can sell them for here. So it's like a farmer selling his sheep or cows at half the price he can get from it. It's pointless, really. Yeah. So the price for crayfish is expensive because the Chinese, there's a supply and demand there. They love our red, high quality crayfish over there. The reason we sell to them and not the domestic market is our costs are quite high. We've got to pay for things like bait, diesel. If we replace this engine, that'd be $150,000 straight up. So I think some people don't realise how expensive it is to actually catch crayfish. If the price is only $30 a kilo, you're breaking even.
Sam chose to return to fishing when the Chinese market came back, despite the South Australian government giving fishermen the option to roll over their unused quota into next season.
Initially, I was going to roll it over just basically because of the price. The price wasn't there. But once the price did return to the higher level, I think it's a bit... Because the price is good, I think we really should be out there catching it instead of taking for granted that they're rolling it over. I think it's good if the fishermen make an effort. The government came to the table and let us roll it over. I think the opportunity was there to catch it, so I took it. I think it just looks better for the industry in general, even though I've got no problem with people rolling their quota over at all.
And as an industry, the pandemic hit pretty hard, but you do seem to be pretty optimistic about things. Why is that?
We were hit hard like a couple of months before most industries were hit. You had to be optimistic just because... I don't know, there's no point in getting negative about something you've got no control over. So I was positive that we would recover before a lot of other industries because we'd been hit first. The quicker China recovered, the better it was for us. People were worried to start with. I think there was a lot of angst. There was a lot of the unknown. So fishermen were a bit worried what was going to happen to their industry, their livelihood, to be honest. And So people are coming up with ideas of far out ideas of how they're going to fix everything. But I think you just sort of had to let it happen and it will always pick up. Most fishermen just stopped, waited, took a breath and waited to see what would happen. And once the price rose up, people started fishing in bits and pieces. And the actual industry worked well like that. Some people went back earlier and other people waited so people could sell their crays, stuff like that. So I think the industry did really well. Yeah, well, you never really take this job for granted. I think we're really lucky with what we do. We're really, really lucky with the amount of money we make.
That was Rock Lobster Fisherman Sam Gardner finishing that report by Bridget Herman. And we're going to stay with fishing because the West Coast abalone industry says it's set for a significant boost if some marine parks are reopened for taking the shellfish. The state government has said it could relax fishing restrictions in some parks as part of its fishing industry overhaul. Jonas Wolford from the state's Abalone Industry Association says it could be a timely move with international markets opening up again.
So this is the opportunity for community members to respond to the changes to the six parks that Minister Spears has released.
Why is this so significant for the abalone industry and particularly on the West Coast?
The proposal is looking at allowing access back into some of the St. Francis group of islands. St. Francis itself, West and Dog, Massillon and Fenelon are still within a sanctuary zone. And then the sanctuary zone will be extended further south to pick up Cannon Reef and Hart Island. As well as this, we're going to increase the area out at Noyts Reef. So we're actually looking at increasing the green sanctuary zone area in the west of the state.
Historically, how important were these regions to the industry and what has been lost?
The abalone industry, or the western zone, was harvesting around 12 tonne whole weight a year out of that St. Francis area. And that was largely responsible for most of the impact that we've felt and the one licence having to be removed. And 5 years on, because it's interrupted the rotation harvest, we've seen now that we've had to take a decrease on our greenlit quota.
So how significant will this be for the industry?
This will be really significant because it will allow that natural rotation to be reinstated that we'd been working on for the last 30, 40 years. And also it means that there will be the 22 boats will travel up to Ceduna and work, whereas currently they're not. That was really ceased about 5 years ago when that sanctuary zone came in. So it's going to be a huge plus for the Ceduna region and along the coast here. It will allow that abalone to be sold overseas again, which is really important, bringing those international dollars into these coastal towns.
But these have been marine parks. Doesn't it defeat the purpose? I mean, is it hardly a marine park if you're out there taking fish?
We are one of the most highly managed fisheries in South Australia, and the monitoring that takes place is really high. It's a low trophic species, so in the food chain, there's not any other species that rely on it. So when we're down there hand selecting with no impact on the actual habitat itself, other than the removal of the size abalone, we are basically making no impact to the ecosystem.
That was Jonas Wolford from the state's abalone industry speaking with Tim Jeans. Now we have to find out what's happening after the program on Sonia Feldhoff's show. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, Cassie. Now, obviously, it's pretty hard to take your eyes off the vision that's coming out of the United States at the moment with all of the race riots underway now for several days. And of course, as we look and think about that being quite far away, you might think, gee, aren't we lucky to be in Australia? But of course, we're looking at that as we mark Reconciliation Week. We will have Ghana Elder Geoffrey Newchurch on the program with us today, reflecting on the race situation he's seeing over there, and I guess at this important time in Australia's marking and calendar as well. And of course, spiders are out and about, and Chris Messenger, our bugs and slugs expert, is along to talk about all of those things and answer your questions. Plus, our whistling league will see Deb Tribe pitting her whistling wits or talents against Vic Pisani's today.
I had the most gigantic redback spider in my storeroom on the weekend. I don't think I've seen one so big, so they are definitely out and about. It'll be interesting to hear what you've got on the show. Thanks so much for that, Sonia. That's all we have time for in the program today. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.